Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. Whether it is concern over cybersecurity or the legal battle between Apple and the courts over encryption, we're reminded that we have not yet worked out the relationship among technology, privacy, security, and public safety. And so in this hour, we'll hear from Fred Kaplan. He is the national security columnist for Slate, and he'll be in conversation with Herbert Lin of the Center for International Security and Cooperation at Stanford University. This event was recorded in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience. And now to our moderator, Herbert Lin.
So to start out, what led you to start thinking about doing this report on this book on the wizards of cyberspace?
Right, that is kind of what it is. All of my books are basically the same book, or at least three of them are. It's the same structure. They have similar beginnings and endings. You can do a literary analysis in that regard. Well, it's a fairly prosaic story. My editor, Alice Mayhew at Simon & Schuster, about the time I was done with the last book, or the time it came out, she goes, "Well, what's the next big thing in warfare?" And I said, "Well, this cyber thing might be big." This is 6 months before anybody ever heard of Edward Snowden,
okay.
Before cyber attacks were daily front page headlines. And she goes, "Well, what's that?" And I said, "Well, it has to do with this." And frankly, I didn't know very much about it. I'd read a few books and I knew a couple of people, but I walked out of her office thinking, well, I better look in to see if this is a story, because I write stories,
mm-hmm.
you know. And it turned out that it was a story, and a pretty interesting one that nobody had ever told. And so then I got into, it got to be more difficult than I figured, because two things that I didn't know going into this was that, first, we have been doing cyber offensive stuff for a long time. Number two, all of that stuff is by nature classified. So now I should say, especially for the cameras, that I learned a couple of things that I did not include in the book. I mean, I'm not interested in blowing stuff up, so to speak. But it took a little bit of pulling teeth and triangulating and going back and talking with people many times to get this story down on paper.
Okay, if you were to say something that was the most surprising for you in this, of the things that you learned, you alluded to one of them, that we've been on the offensive for a long time. What else strikes you as being really surprising?
Well, I mean, the most surprising thing, and it's how the book begins, and that is that U.S. policy towards cyber started when Ronald Reagan watched War Games. Remember the movie War Games, 1983, about Matthew Broderick plays this tech whiz teenager who unwittingly hacks into the main computer at the North American Aerospace Defense Command, and thinking that he's gotten into a new online game, almost sets off World War III. Okay, so Ronald Reagan, he's up at Camp David for one of his five-day weekends in early June 1983, and he watches War Games. And the next Wednesday, there's a meeting in the White House, and it's about the MX missile. You remember the MX missile? And there, all of his advisors are there. And he, at one point, he puts down his index cards, and he says, "Has anybody seen this movie, War Games?" Okay, nobody'd seen it. It just came out. So he launches into this very detailed plot description. And people are looking around the room like, where is this going? And so he turns to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General John Vesey, and says, "General, could something like this really happen? Could someone just break into our most secure computer?" And the general says, "I'll look into that, Mr. President," which is what generals are supposed to do. And a week later, he comes back and he says, "Mr. President, the problem is much worse than you think." And this leads to the first National Security Decision Directive on computer security. Now, it took a kind of a detour because it ended up being written by the NSA. And the way it was written was that the NSA was going to control and set the standards for all computers in the United States, civilian, military, business, personal. So there were some people on Capitol Hill who didn't much like that. NSA is supposed to just do foreign intelligence. So they divided it up, where NSA will do .mil and classified, and the Commerce Department would do everything else. Well, of course, the Commerce Department didn't have the resources or technical know-how to do anything. And the NSA at the time had no interest in doing it. If you find a vulnerability, you exploit it. You don't patch it. So this problem just, you know, it was being worked on behind the scenes, but it didn't become a big issue until the late 1990s. But the point is that with that one crazy incident, Ronald Reagan asking this question that had everybody in the room rolling their eyeballs after watching War Games, unleashed the tensions and the conflicts and the controversies over policies between different, not just liberty versus security, which is an old one, but different notions of security that continue, you know, down to literally today.
Well, say more about these different notions of security, which are, of course, at the heart of many of the tensions that we're seeing today, you know, play out in Congress and the,
right.
For example, in the Apple FBI dispute.
Well, the Apple FBI is a classic case. I mean, for many years, and this is one thing that isn't generally understood. One of the most interesting things I find in this Apple FBI case is that one side is trying to rupture and the other side is trying to preserve an arrangement that's really been going on for a long time. In the 1920s, a U.S. intelligence group that went by the nickname of the Black Code struck an arrangement with Western Union where they could get access to all the telegraphs that were coming in and out of the country. Then, of course, when the phones happened, the NSA was tapping into phones. With the internet age, it actually got to be, this is something that a lot of people in Silicon Valley do not want to tell you, is it became a two-way street. If you're a software company and you want to sell stuff to the Defense Department, it's got to be vetted through security people. And who are those people? Well, it's the director, it's the Information Assurance Director at the NSA. So the first Microsoft Windows program, or operating system, the NSA found 1,500 points of vulnerability in this. And they patched almost all of them. You know, they left a few doors so that when, you know, the foreigners would buy this, because everybody's buying the same stuff. And Google had their Chrome system. The source code was completely hacked into by the Chinese, and the NSA helped them fix it. And so this is the dilemma. On the one hand, for national security, the NSA and the FBI like to have little back doors that they can get into in case, so they can hack, you know, the Russians or Chinese or whoever else is buying this. But what's been happening in the last decade or more is that the NSA doesn't have a monopoly on this. A lot of people can do this. And so if they can find these doors, so can a lot of other people. And so it's not just liberty versus security. It's the security of that system. The NSA is saying we need to have, and the FBI, you know, we need to have ways to get into this. And, you know, these are rational arguments that they can present. It's on the other hand, you know, if it's open to them, it's also open to everybody else who can hack into you. And that is a growing number of people. And so that's the real, this phone that was owned, but it wasn't even owned by this mass murderer. It was owned by the county, and they've given consent to have it. It's a very strange test case for this. But the phone really has very little to do with it. It's pretty much known what was on this phone. And if it was really an urgent matter, I mean, if the national security people said, we need to know what's in this phone right now, the NSA could have gone to the Attorney General and gotten an order signed, and they would know what was in this phone right now.
The FBI.
No, I mean the NSA.
The NSA would have done it.
The FBI would have asked the NSA, and the NSA would have said yes, yes.
Right.
And they have ways of getting into stuff that, I mean, it's beyond science fiction because it's not fiction. So I think it can be inferred. You remember like the whole thing about metadata where, you know, the data, the business records kept by the phone services that, you know, what numbers I've dialed, what numbers have dialed me. That's all out there. That's already known. This guy wasn't in the phone. It's already been said that the metadata showed no foreign calls coming in on this phone. So this is being elevated by both sides as a battle royale of basic principles in the future of encryption.
Unlike with a nuclear weapon, which doesn't really care very much what you aim it at. I mean, you're gonna if you get within the blast radius of it, you're gonna cook it, right? And you're gonna destroy it. It's not like that with computers, right? Because you can make one of these phones, you know, pretty much hack-proof, in very interesting ways. And then the question is, are you allowed to sell that?
I think there have been times in history when technology advances, and the people in the intelligence community say, oh no, what are we going to do now? Like fax machines. How are we going to hack into fax machines? They have found a way. But no, it's getting harder and harder with what's going on.
I will speak here as a former hacker, back before it was illegal, by the way. So no statute of limitations gone, no retrospective laws. Okay, so we can disagree on that, but we both agree that it is getting much harder, and it is certainly true that it's possible to develop encryption methods, for example, that nobody can break into in the age of the universe.
Yeah.
But you know what happens then is they don't bother breaking into it; they try to find some way of stealing the key to give you access.
Yeah.
So it's those kinds of circumventions that
if you can bring in the technology, you don't need to.
Right.
But you know, my concern is that if Apple does win this case in the courts, and I don't know, I think it's a very dodgy test case for the principals. But you know, I can see, and in fact, Dianne Feinstein has now co-sponsored legislation that says a company must allow its encryption to be overridden if the government submits a lawful warrant. And to me, that, you know, that becomes a much more serious thing than this particular instance that Apple is blocking.
Right, because
then it says, we win. We're into you no matter what you do.
Right, and what it says is that there are certain kinds of products that you can't design and sell.
Which means that R&D in this will probably dry up, because what's the point? Why should I, you know, go through the next round of escalation in this if the FBI and the NSA can just say, forget it, here's a warrant, let us in? Yeah, exactly.
As you pointed out, there's a sense in which it's security versus it's offensive security versus defensive security. You get security by being able to break into a terrorist's phone. No, I don't think anybody would disagree with that. And you also get security by being able to protect the good guys' communications and data, right?
Right.
So did you get, in doing this, did you get any sense of, for yourself, of, in some sense, which was more important? Because those two do come into conflict at some point. And where do you come down on it?
Yeah, well, you know, it's a little bit more complicated even than that. Several years ago, they developed, you know, when the military gets into something, they develop acronyms for it, right? So early on, there was computer network defense, CND, computer network attack, CNA, but then there was this medium thing called computer network exploitation, CNE. Now, this could mean two things. You could call it active defense. In other words, the best way to know whether somebody is going to attack you is to get inside his network and see what he's doing. So that, you know, you can't protect everything. So you get inside, and you can see when he's planning an attack. But at the same time, CNE is just one step away from CNA. If you're in there already, all you have to do is, like, push one more button, and you've attacked it. And in fact, what has been going on in the last more than a decade is, I mean, you know, we're into everybody's infrastructure, and there everybody is into our infrastructure, and you know, you might, all sides might have perfectly good reasons for being there. Well, we want to know what you're doing, or in the case of a country like China or something, they might want to know how we're doing certain things, maybe so they can rip it off. I mean, which is what they do with a lot of things. But here's the danger. The danger is, and actually I'll tell a little side story about how I got the title of this book. You know, this is my fifth book, And every time I write a book, I say to myself, okay, the title will emerge in the notes. The title will emerge. It never does. It never does. In this case, it did. I'm going over the notes for an interview with Robert Gates, former Secretary of Defense, and he's telling me that back when he first became secretary, he's getting these daily briefings on hackings into the Pentagon, the defense industry, and he goes to his colleagues and he says, look, you know, we have to do something. You know, there are no rules of the road here. I mean, well, you know, when I was director of the CIA at the height of the Cold War, there were rules. You know, the Americans and the Russians, we had certain rules, like we don't kill each other's spies. So we need to do something like this. What kinds of targets we don't hit with this? And he goes, we need rules of the road because we are wandering in dark territory. So I said, wow, there's the title of this book. And then I figured, well, I better look to see if this means something. So I Googled, you know, dark territory. And it turns out that this is a term of art in the North American railroad industry to designate stretches of track that are not governed by signals. And I say, wow, what a great metaphor. This is fabulous. So I emailed him and I said, did you know this? And he said, yeah, sure. My grandfather was a station master for 50 years with the Santa Fe Railroad in Pratt, Kansas. We used railroad terminology all the time. You know, I was like, wow, this is great. So that's where the title comes from. So the thing is, there are no rules of the road. Unlike nuclear weapons, where there is a very thick red line between not using nuclear weapons and using nuclear weapons, which is one reason why nobody has used any, because you might say, we could get a nice military advantage by using this 1 kiloton nuclear weapon, but nobody knows what might happen afterwards.
And you know when a nuclear weapon has been used.
You know when it's been used, and you know where it came from. I mean, especially if it's a ballistic missile, you can retrace the arc. And, you know. But with cyber attacks, there are already a zillion of them. Who knows what everybody's thinking is about the line between a nuisance and a real threat. So somebody could cross over this line without even knowing it. And, you know, to the extent we have a doctrine in this, which we really don't, but to the extent there's one, officials have said we reserve the right to respond to cyber attacks through non-cyber means. So this and then it's also harder to trace. We're getting much better at tracing them, but it's not a 100% thing. And so, you know, you could start pulling funny business with this fine line between CNE and CNA and get yourself in a very fast escalation to warfare along a route that nobody's ever traveled before. You know, in terms of this metaphor for dark territory, you know, the stretch of dark territory is very long, very vast. You don't know who the engineers are, and the crash up could be much greater than, you know, two trains running into each other.
So let me invite you to consider the kind of nightmare scenario you're thinking about. Let's say the facts are that we have our cyber agents, software, and so on, running around in Elbonia's nuclear command and control system. Okay,
Whose?
Elbonia.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I don't want to use any names, right? But you can choose your own value for Elbonia. Okay, and all of these agents are looking for information. That is, they are explicitly. You look at them, you see the code in it. It's for the purpose of CNE, for exploitation. From our side, we're doing this because we want to know what's going on over there.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to overreact, right? When they move their missiles around, it's just an exercise or something. Like, we want to know that, okay? How will they see it if they find our...
If they find out? Well, yeah. People tend to take the worst case scenario, right? Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, this isn't generally known, but there's one part of the Information Assurance Directorate of the NSA that constantly make sure that the button is secure.
Button. The nuclear button, right.
That's on our side.
Right.
In other words, that nobody has hacked the connection between the black box that's going around with the president all the time to the National Military Command Center, to the missiles, you could say that's like their number one thing. They are checking on that constantly. Now, you know, you could ask, well, why do they do that? Well, because they know that theoretically or otherwise it is possible. to hack into something like that. Maybe that somebody has hacked into some other country's command control like that. The first phrase that was ever devised for this kind of warfare back in the late 70s was counter-command control warfare. The idea was you get inside, not just nuclear, but you get inside the other guy's command control network, so you send them false messages, you rejigger things, you adjust settings, and the idea is that you not only do you mess up the other guy's war plans, but you make them jittery. You make them not trust what they're looking at. And that later became called information warfare, and now we call it cyber warfare. But it's part psychological warfare, and it's messing with the heads of the people who are at the very top.
So, for example, if you can't trust the information you're getting, what do you do?
Yeah.
And it doesn't take very much for you to not trust what you're getting.
Well, you know, there's a story that also I found out about in the course of doing this. Back in 1997, there was a military exercise called Eligible Receiver. And the head of the NSA at the time was a three-star Air Force general named Ken Minahan, who knew quite a lot about the vulnerability of the computer networks because he had been commander of some pretty unknown outfit called the Air Force Information Warfare Center in San Antonio, where they were playing these games. So he was frustrated that none of his general colleagues were taking any of this seriously. So he proposed a game where a team of 25 NSA guys would hack into the Defense Department's networks. He had to go through a lot of lawyers to get this done. And one thing that they demanded was that these elite hackers had to use commercially available equipment. He couldn't hack into U.S. stuff using their top secret SIGINT stuff. So this was lined up, and it was very, very secretive. It was called a no-notice exercise, and there's the people who were going to be subjected to this didn't know that an exercise was going on. So they laid aside 2 weeks to do this, and they prepared for it for about 3 months. And within 4 days, the entire Defense Department's network was completely hacked, and only about two people even noticed it. One of it was a smart Marine out in the Pacific who saw something funny going on, but he didn't know what to do. That there were no procedures, there were no protocols. Like in most things of life, you know what to do. You know, like if the alarm, if there's a fire going on, there's a signal, you run out the. Nobody knew it, so he disconnected his computer from there, which was a smart thing to do. But anyway, it got completely hacked, everything. And again, sometimes they'd just leave a little marker, you know, Kilroy was here. Other times they sent phony messages, and then they gave a briefing showing everything that they were doing. And people, and that really is when the military started taking this seriously. But, you know, we're talking 20 years ago. Another interesting little fact, which was pretty tightly held even at the time, while these NSA guys were inside the networks plowing around, they ran across a few French IPs, just kind of real hackers. This is in 1997. And of course, they expelled them. But I mean, this was not a theoretical exercise, even way back then. And then the very next year, the Russians start hacking into our stuff, the Chinese. And we're, of course, it was very interesting. Somebody early on when I was doing the research, someone who is quite high up in intelligence circles, I was asking about these commission reports about various vulnerabilities. Because look, there's something you have to keep in mind here. All of these scenarios that were drawn up in these things, what other people might do to us, the root of all this is that we were doing this to other people, other government. And at some point, somebody said, oh, Jesus, you know, maybe what we can do to them, they can someday do to us. That's what governed all of it. And there's a Groundhog Day element to it in that these things just keep coming up over and over and over. Like, oh, there's a big panic, and then, you know, a new administration comes in, nobody knows anything. You know, I mean, President Obama just came out with something called the Cybersecurity National Action Plan, and there's going to be a bipartisan commission. This is like the seventh or eighth thing that is called something like the Cybersecurity National Action Plan. there was a Defense Science Board study in the Pentagon a couple of years ago where they concluded that our architecture is inherently vulnerable. So they've kind of concluded, okay, it's not like we don't check on the locks now and then, but we have to assume that they're going to get in. And so the big buzzwords now in the military are detection and resilience. Just make sure that when they get in, you know that very quickly, and you can kick them out and repair and restore the damage. One thing that I learned after the book was done, so it's not in the book, is that the Navy is now starting to teach navigators on ships how to use a sextant to guide with the stars, because they figure that the data link to the GPS might get hacked. And then our entire qualitative edge militarily is in systems that are linked to computers. And if computers are vulnerable, that whole dimension of our military capability is, could be screwed.
I wish I knew about eligible receiver when it was happening, and I knew about the results, and they are as you describe. And the interesting question then is, what has happened since then? And I will tell you, unfortunately, that things are a little bit better, but not a whole lot. Example of this in particular. Just 3 weeks ago, I was at an Army exercise of a regiment doing field training against a genuine opposing force. There was an opposing force being the red team against them. And the exercise was advertised as, they have completely free play. They can do whatever they want the way an adversary would do it. And I said, really free play? They can do anything? They said, yes. I said, including cyber? They sort of looked down, they shuffled their feet a little bit. It was, no, not exactly. I say, why not? Because they say, in our experience, what Fred described was exactly what happens. If you give them full free play, they just shut down the exercise. And it costs $5 million to put on the exercise, and now they've wasted $5 million because they can't do their other training.
Yeah. So I mean, what's happened? I mean, things have improved in the sense that, there's a whole bureaucracy devoted to, there's something that was called originally Joint Task Force Computer Network Defense, and, if you do see that you're getting hacked, there are things to do. But, this is an arms race, and the ratio between the offense and defense is about the same. The defense is a lot better. It's really excellent at staving off the computer network attack of, say, 2004, but not so much the one of today.
Let me ask you one more question, and then we'll open it up to the audience. I couldn't tell from reading the book, but so I'll phrase it like this. There are many people who believe in the United States, in the computer, especially in the computer industry and so on, who believe that by focusing so much on offense, you're actually weakening the defense. And I was wondering if you had a view on that in cyber.
Well, I mean, yeah, it goes back to this thing about you're creating back doors that other people can get into. And that's certainly true. But what has happened in the last several years is this whole, the elevation of CNE, the computer network exploitation, where it's become clear that, in the military, actually, they've gotten it down. So there are only about 8 points where military networks cross the internet. So if you want to just sit on these networks so that you can keep people out or at least see when they're coming in, and since the NSA has legal authority to do this with the military, you can do a pretty good job. But they have not even been able to count the number of networks, say, in civilian government, much less in any place else. And so they say, Jesus, that's pointless, it's hopeless. So if you look now even at open literature, Defense Department documents, they define defense as offense. I mean, it's getting inside the networks. That's the way that you can stop them. The way one document put it, to stop them before the attack begins, which means that you're in there and you see what's going on.
You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. We're hearing from Fred Kaplan. He's the national security columnist for Slate. He's in conversation with Herbert Lin, senior research scholar for cyber policy and security at Stanford's CSAC. The event was recorded in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience. And now back to our conversation.
Okay, what I'm going to do is provide some questions here. And the first one is, often hear this, is cyber war overhyped? And this person asks, it seems like it's a supplement to kinetic war, like electronic warfare, not just something off by itself.
Well, I think that's right. I have two. One, I mean, you know, I think James Clapper, the director of national intelligence, said in some hearing the other day that this is the biggest threat we face. Well, I mean, you know, come on. There are still several thousand nuclear weapons in the world. And, you know, I would rather have all of my stuff thoroughly hacked than the smallest nuclear weapon detonate in my city or country. So, I mean, you know, the biggest, gravest threat, I don't know. It's a huge source of revenue, both for the Defense Department, which is not one of the fastest growing things, and of course the industry. I was doing some things at the RSA. I mean, my God, I mean, it's a convention hall full of companies, some quite traditional, some startups, who are all saying the same thing. You know, the threat is real, and we have the unique solution that you need to buy. You know, that's every company that you've ever heard of has not just an information technology specialist, but an information security specialist who's safeguarding the credit cards and what. So it's a big source. But yeah, on the other hand, you know, well, if there is a conventional war with a power that has these things, I think cyber war is definitely going to be a part of it. But, you know, if terrorists ever get hold of the ability to do this, and I don't think they have as yet, there's a lot of very disruptive things you can do to a society where you don't have to fly in terrorists, take down an airplane like on 9/11. You can hack into a series of banks or waterworks or power dams or other things from halfway across the world and have incredibly disruptive effects. And while, you know, banks have actually gotten pretty good at this because, you know, what their industry is money and trust, and people can take money and erode trust. But, you know, like the electrical industry, things like this, their view is, why should I bother? It's very expensive. Nobody really knows how to do it. And the cost of actually preventing it isn't that much less than cleaning up the damage afterwards. It's still very, very primitive at that point. So, yeah, it is overhyped for a variety of reasons, but I think it's also, you know, quite serious.
So one of the interesting notes on that is that if you look at the Department of Defense cyber strategy, it says explicitly that cyber is the pre-kinetic option, that is in times of heightened tension, that is before the shooting actually starts, that's when we might do interesting things.
I would add to that, too. If everybody is into everybody else's stuff, and it looks like things are building, then there is an incentive to launch a preemptive strike of this sort before the other side launches a preemptive strike. So the very existence of this has built-in mechanisms for escalation while you think that what you're doing is preventing escalation. That's sort of the irony.
So, as it turns out, nobody really understands very well what the people in the business would call escalation dynamics. That's, by the way, one of the things that I researched at Stanford. The other point that I wanted to highlight in what you said about the terrorists was that, you know, yes, everything I didn't disagree with anything there. And one added point. They don't have to learn how to do the hacking themselves. They can now buy those services on the net.
Okay. There's lots of guys.
Lots of guys who are willing to sell
you
hacking
services. That's what the North Koreans do, for example. They have guys in Thailand and Singapore who do this for them.
Okay, so another question here. aren't there some systems, for example, the systems that control the electric power grid and so on, that are just too dangerous to connect to the internet? What did you come away with?
Yeah, well, but they are. They are connected to the internet because this started happening 20 years ago. And you can understand why. It saves on labor. It saves costs of all sorts. It allows for economies of scale. You just lasso them all up together. And also, you know, things like, for example, your car. You know, if you have a new car and you're pushing on the accelerator, you might as well be pushing it. The mechanics are complete. It's all controlled by computers. And these are hooked up to network computers. And this is a really useful thing because, say, you want some guy at a service center to do online diagnostics. You don't have to drive it into the garage and let it sit there for several. He can do it online. He can get into your system. He can look at all. And, you know, there was this experiment done last year where two guys, one of whom had worked as an analyst in the elite hacking unit of the NSA, which is called Tailored Access Operations, and he figured out how to hack into a Jeep Cherokee and completely commandeer the thing. Its steering wheel, its brakes, its accelerator, everything. Well, I mean, think of it this way. Some of these cars, they have systems where you never learned how to parallel park. That's okay. Push this. You know, there are sensors. It'll see how far away this car is, how far away that car is, how far away from the curb, and it'll do it for you. Well, if it can go like this, it can also go like this. So this is even more secretive than a drone strike. At least with a drone strike, you can't see the bomb coming, but afterwards you say, well, there must have been a drone strike here. Here it's like, well, Jesus, the guy just lost control of his car somehow. It's really very creepy.
And one question that comes up is, why do you have these systems connected to the internet in the first place? The suggestion was, let's just not do that.
Okay. Yeah, well, it's convenient. There was, you know, back in 1997 or 8, there was a presidential commission on this. And they went around doing hearings, and they would ask. They figured out it was about critical infrastructure. And they figured, okay, what is critical infrastructure? You know, the electricity, the power. And they went around asking people, now, what are you doing about security? They had no idea what this meant. What is security? Yeah, you've got all this stuff hooked up on the internet. What are you doing? It's like they didn't know it was a problem. And a lot of these critical infrastructure industries are still behaving as if it's not a problem.
Well, I mean, another example of that, if you think about it, is you've all of you have heard about, and maybe some of you have been affected directly by the compromise of medical records, right? Mm. Anthem and so on.
Yeah, so, there was a scenario of this in Homeland, and you know, I think Dick Cheney at one point, there was, when he had his pacemaker, there was genuine, they had to reprogram, the NSA had to come in and reprogram his pacemaker so it wouldn't be vulnerable to.
Pacemakers have a remote, Wi-Fi update feature.
Your doctor,
right?
Or whatever.
So
yeah.
That you, so that they don't have, if they have to reprogram your pacemaker, yeah, they don't have to open you up. This is, you'd like to have this. But of course, once you have that connection, you can hack into the pacemaker.
Yeah.
And Cheney, you know, decided not to do that.
Or let's say somebody really wanted to cause trouble, and this really is terrorism because there's no political strategic thing in this. Let's say they just want to go into a hospital and just change everybody's blood records. Like this patient, he doesn't have type A, B plus, he has type B minus blood. Or he should have this much insulin instead of that much insulin. Or he should, and people are looking at this, and you know, I mean, the reason why that's unlikely because it would cause total chaos without anybody realizing that something systematic was going on. You know, people like something dramatic. But, you know, people have hacked into 411 systems. They've hacked into, everything really is wired these days. And if you're wired, there are people who know how to get inside. You know, people ask me, because they knew I was writing this book, they said, oh, what can I do to protect myself? And I said, well, look, you know, if all you're worried about is, say, a criminal or some punk kids in California hacking into your bank account. There are things you can do. But if somebody is really good, and especially if they're a nation state, and they want to come after you, they want to get into your stuff, there's really nothing you can do about it.
Are we going to be seeing more of the attacks like Stuxnet? which was the attack on the Iranian centrifuges.
Well, Stuxnet was very complicated. I mean, that was, they worked on that one for a long, long time. But I think you're seeing mini Stuxnets of various kinds going on continuously. There was a story in the New York Times just the other day based on this new documentary that Obama had approved. By the way, any kind of cyber offensive campaign has to be approved by the president, no matter whether it's something small or something large. So he had approved a campaign in case the nuclear talks with Iran collapsed. We had a kind of a follow-on to Stuxnet going on, where we would start messing with their centrifuges or other things through cyber means. So, you know, these programs exist. It's been said that somebody said, oh, yeah, we have cyber offensive things against ISIS. Now, I don't know what those are, but I can tell you that, for example, during the Iraq War, this is one thing that's in the book, you know, in 2007, when things kind of turned around a little bit in the Iraq War, and part of that was because of the surge, and part of it was General Petraeus coming in and this new counterinsurgency strategy. But one part that nobody ever talked about is that the NSA got involved. The NSA and Joint Strategic Operations Command started cooperating, and NSA actually set up a base inside of Iraq. And over a period of a few years, there were 6,000 NSA people in Iraq. And what they would do, they would capture computers of these insurgents. They would get into the computers. They would hack into them. They would do things like sending a message, like, let's all meet at 3:15 tomorrow at such and such. And there'd be special operations forces waiting for them to kill them. There were 4,000 insurgents killed in this way in 2007. Also, you know, drones weren't just for firing, they're also for surveillance. So if you saw somebody planting a roadside bomb and then you watched them go, well, it used to be that information had to go back to the Pentagon, and then it had to go here, and then it had to go there, and then it would, by the time it got back, it would be 16 hours later, and the guy, who knows where he is now. Well, with the NSA on the scene, they could do this in 1 minute, and they were able to kill a lot of guys who had planted roadside bombs, which was by far the biggest source of American casualties in that war. So somebody, when I first started learning about this and I asked someone, he goes, his eyes widened, he goes, this is sort of to the Iraq War what breaking the German submarine codes was, but I can't tell you anything more. But other people did tell me more. So it played now of course, you know, the Iraq War, all of this military part was just a means to an end. It was the idea of giving some space so that the political factions could get their act together. And of course, Maliki, the prime minister, didn't want to get his act together, so it was all for naught. But strictly from a tactical, technical, military standpoint, the kinds of tricks that the NSA did had played a major role in what was going on.
Would you be willing to say anything to the audience here that you didn't put into your book that you thought was interesting? I mean, you alluded to that. You can't put everything in, and some stuff you withheld because you think it's too sensitive.
Yeah.
That's fine. Is there something that's in the middle category?
I'm not a wasteful writer. As I said, I did put together a couple of things and got them confirmed to various ashen-faced people I was talking with, that I did not put in the book. But I think pretty much all the interesting stories otherwise are there.
Okay. Stuxnet was successful to a certain definition of success in Iran. Why can't we do stuff like that to North Korea?
Well, the thing about North Korea, and this is where the throwing rocks from glass houses comes in, North Korea is not a terribly wired society. You know, after the whole North Korean hacking of Sony, and then Obama said, we will take measures to retaliate, and then a few days later, the North Korean internet just shut down. Now, in fact, the United States government had nothing to do with that. North Korea thinks that it did, and it has good reasons. But there are only like 1,000 IPs in the entire country, and they're all connected to one server in China. It's trivial to shut it down. And in terms of their nuclear infrastructure and all of the things that we might be interested in playing tricks with, they're not networked at all. So the fact that they are so primitive means that they're not terribly susceptible to this kind of attack, just as the fact that we are so sophisticated, we are so advanced, we invented this whole thing. We designed both the technology and the weapons and everything about it, and we are more wired than any other country on Earth, which makes us the most able to do this kind of stuff, but it also makes us the most vulnerable to anybody else coming after us. So when you say, you know, like with nuclear stuff, it's we will retaliate in kind. Against a country like North Korea, what does that mean? There is no in kind. There is not a target, unless you say, well, we're going to drop bombs on what we. And again, we have, the government has said that we reserve the right to respond to cyber attacks through non-cyber means. That's what that means. A remark like that is directed at a country like North Korea. Like, don't think you can get away with something because we can't hack into your network because you have no network. We'll do other things, you know.
And in 2006, it's not a part of official doctrine anymore, but at least it's not written down anymore. But in 2006, there was an explicit written statement by the Joint Chiefs of Staff that the response to cyber could include nukes. So that's an interesting tidbit.
Yeah, but remember, any kind of offensive plan has to be approved by the president. So unless you want to go elect Donald Trump or Ted Cruz, it's probably not likely to happen. Nuclear offensive.
Somebody asked, you know, on the doomsday clock continuum, where does cyber fit in?
You know, I've never been a fan of this doomsday clock thing. I mean, it was like a sales point for the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists for many years. You know, it'd be 3 minutes to midnight. You know, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists moved the clock from 5 minutes to midnight to 3 minutes to midnight. What does that mean? I have no idea. And we set it back to 6 minutes to midnight now. Well, what? What are you talking about? And again, it depends what you mean. It's this wandering in dark territory. A bank gets hacked. That happens all the time. Okay. Is that a matter of national security? What about two banks? What about three banks? What about six? Where do you draw the line? I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question. You know, a defense industry gets hacked. All the records for the F-35 airplane get hacked. And what do you know, about 5 years later, China has an F-35 type airplane. Is that something worth declaring war over? Probably not. What is worth? I mean, the thing is, this has been studied now for 30, 40 years, and the Pentagon's Defense Science Board has a panel writing a report right now on what is cyber deterrence. They don't know. And the people on this panel, many of them are the same people who have been on these commissions and other things for the last 30 years. This is a funny story. I was interviewing one of these guys, and he's been involved in a lot of stuff. And the commission was just getting started, and he says to me, "He says, so what do you know about cyber deterrence?" And I said, "I don't know. I can't find anybody who does. I was hoping you could tell me." And he goes, "Oh man, that's a shame, because I was going to invite you to be on this commission." And I'm thinking, Jesus Christ, they have to think about inviting me to be on this commission? Oh no, we're in bad shape.
You would have had to have a clearance.
I couldn't have done it. Yeah, I would have had to get a clearance, a very high clearance, and then I'd have to have this book, you know, been gone over by the agency censors,
and then burned,
or lots of black marks, you know, all through the manuscript, which might have been a selling point in its own right, but not a very interesting book, I'm afraid.
Right, you could sell a book with a lot of black marks. Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah.
U.S. currently has superiority in cyber warfare. What countries are at risk of overtaking us?
Well, see, it's one of these things that isn't like a counting game. It's what you can do with it. And if you're more vulnerable, you're vulnerable to much less force. But there are about 20 countries that have explicit cyber warfare units within their militaries. Now, are there 20 countries that can really do anything with it? Probably not. But there are 6, 7, 8 that are really getting, or already are, quite good. And they can do, you know, I mean, Israel being obvious one, France, Iran, Russia and China, of course. You know, a few others are fledgling, that they're getting there. Again, you don't need a Manhattan Project to do this. You know, and you can hire other people, as you said, or you can send people to universities where they get, you know, you need a small number of people in a room with some computers. And then there's this one character in my book, he's still around, in fact, a guy who named Peter Zatko, whose handle name was Mudge, that's how he's known, and he had something in Boston called The Loft. And these guys, it was like a handful of guys, and they used refurbished computer gear, and they could do the kinds of things that it had been thought up to then only nation states could do. And these guys were discovered by this guy, Richard Clark, who was working at the White House at the time, and he says, this changes the entire threat model. This handful of guys in the second floor of a warehouse they could hack into anything. They could open up microchips and duplicate stuff from the silicon that was in there. They created equipment that could hack into any Windows program that could get the passwords off of anything. And these kind of that was sort of when hacker became a non-pejorative term. Clark got them in to testify before Congress, and you know, that's kind of a turning point where hacking sort of became taken seriously. And then, you know, one of these guys, Mudge, went to work at DARPA for a little while and commissioned a lot of very interesting projects on the vulnerability, various things.
Is there a way of improving the security of U.S. government databases? Somebody here suggests that maybe we should have a data protection agency or something like that.
Then they'll get hacked. let's centralize it so they can get everything is right there. In the civilian sector, it's hard because, you know, somebody did try to count how many points of intersection agency networks were with the public internet, and they stopped counting in the thousands. And maybe you don't need to protect all of them. You don't need to protect, you know, some Interior Department office in Montana or something. But it is just too complicated, which is how the NSA rationalized we've got to go do, you know, the CNE, the getting inside. Otherwise, we're not going to be able. But, you know, the military, again, that's fairly secure. But who knows? Because, I mean, in 2008, there was detected the first known hacking into a classified military network. And they knew about it only because somebody at the NSA said, well, you know, we've got the entry points pretty well blocked off, but let's kind of go inside and see if somebody's already there. And they found this beacon, and they traced it to Russia, and it was of Central Command, which was the command in charge of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars at the time. And this was classified network. And they think it probably happened when somebody at a base in Kabul bought a thumb drive from one of the, you know, bodegas in the corner outside the base, and it had malware in it, and they inserted it into a computer. And basically the Russians were just kind of waiting for somebody to do this, and somebody did it. And then the NSA, they were very clever on how they got into it. This beacon was sending a signal to home. And so they said, okay, it wants to get a signal back from home. So we'll divert it. We'll create a home right here. And then they basically got it into going into an NSA waste bin. And again, there are lots of very ambivalent and even negative things you can say about the NSA, but the people who work there are very talented. They did all of this. They came up with the idea, devised the program, and tested it within 24 hours. But that was the first known intrusion into classified networks, and it happened only because somebody looked there. So, you know, where you're not looking, who knows what's going on.
So the question about the USB drive and so on, this experiment has been done many times in the commercial sector. So, you take a handful of thumb drives, scatter them in a parking lot at 9 a.m., and there's a program on it that says phone home. And by 12 o'clock, the experiment that I know of says that by 12 o'clock, 3 hours later, 75% of them have had phoned home because they
now we do this too, you know. I mean, it works always. It's never been completely revealed how Stuxnet got intruded. I think it was somebody did it into a printer that was hooked up to the computer governing the power supplies running the centrifuges. But how it actually got there, there is something in the CIA called the Information Operations Center, which does a lot of collaborating with the NSA. Basically, this often, you know, this tailored access operations, which is like the cyber black bags operation in the NSA, sometimes they need somebody to go in and put a little beacon on something or some kind of bug so then they can hack into it remotely, but there needs to be something there. Maybe it was them, maybe it was Unit 8200 of the Israeli cyber. I'm not sure. And in fact, the thing about Stuxnet, I have to confess, there's one chapter that has a lot about Stuxnet, and you won't, if you've really thoroughly read everything out there about Stuxnet, you probably won't learn very much from that chapter, because Stuxnet, you know, all these things are covert operations, and they really crack down on the leakers of Stuxnet to the point where, you know, a four-star general who is the vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff is still under criminal investigation for his role in leaking it. So, I mean, I would be talking to people who were quite free and easygoing and telling me about all kinds of things. And then I would mention Stuxnet. It was like, nothing, just absolutely nothing. The thing that I got that was new was that there was a debate at all levels on the inside about whether to do it because of the inevitable backlash. And in fact, there was backlash. Once it got leaked out and everybody knew what was going on, about 6 months later, Iran launched something, a virus called Shamoon, which they used to hack into Aramco, the Arab American Oil Company, and completely wrecked all 30,000 of their hard drives and put up on every monitor an image of a burning American flag. And they probably could have done more. This was like, you know, yeah, you want to mess with us? Here's what we can do to you. We know how to do this. Among the documents in the Snowden cache of documents was a very highly classified transcript of a conversation between General Alexander, the director of the NSA, and one of his colleagues with the British counterpart saying, yeah, the Iranians have learned from other powers how to do this kind of thing. Other powers meaning us and the Israelis, basically. You know, again, it's not rocket science. It's computer science, but it's not rocket science.
It's not that they've learned how to do the technical side of it. What they've seen is that we've done it and that they could do it too.
They could do it too. Like, okay, let's figure out, let's reverse engineer this. How did they do it? You know, once the worm got out, and again, it was programmed so that if it wasn't aimed at precisely this server, it wouldn't hurt any other servers. But it got out. People were seeing it. And so all these security companies like Symantec and Microsoft and Kaspersky, their job is to report when they see viruses of this sort. And so they described it, and they said, boy, this is a remarkable device. I mean, look, it's got this and this. What could this be for? And so out there in the open literature is a very detailed description of, in fact, what it consisted of. So they were able to replicate it.
On behalf of the World Affairs Council, thanks to all of you for a great question, and especially, let's thank Fred.
Thank you.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a nonprofit organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. This program featured Fred Kaplan, national security columnist for Slate. He was in conversation with Herbert Lin, senior research scholar for cyber policy and security at the Center for International Security and Cooperation. This broadcast is made possible weekly by the generous support of Chevron. Additional funding for post-production is provided by Maria Starr. She's a member of the KQED Producers Circle. Our recording engineer is Jim Bennett. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. Visit us at worldaffairs.org. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.